Everything from medicine to social policy is all supposed to be evidence-based these days. That evidence largely comes from studies and articles in peer-reviewed journals. But just how reliable is the data we read in scientific publications? Joining us now in the studio is Carolyn Beeler. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Megan.
And Carolyn, I want to listen back to some work you did on a specific statistical measurement that's, again, catching a lot of heat these days. You started reporting on this about 2 years ago, and back then you asked me to listen to a song.
Yes, exactly. I asked you to listen to When I'm 64, the song by the Beatles, and tell me how it made you feel.
When I get older, losing my head, many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine, birthday greetings, bottle of wine?
All right, how do you feel? Do you feel younger?
No. Why would I feel younger?
Well, because that song, When I'm 64 by the Beatles, has been proven to make people almost a year and a half younger.
Hold on. Make them younger or make them feel younger?
Make them younger. That was proven in a study that found that listening to the song had a statistically significant impact on age. Joe Simmons is one of the University of Pennsylvania researchers who published the study.
You could argue that we found the fountain of youth. All you have to do is listen to the song about old age and it makes you younger. So obviously that's not true.
You are right, Mike, and totally bogus. The group that listened to the song just happened to be younger than the group they compared them to, but Simmons manipulated the data to make it appear that the song was actually causing the age difference.
And for what reason?
That's a good question. The point was to show how statistical techniques can end up being misused to skew data, even when researchers are trying to do everything by the book. And it's become part of a much larger conversation about whether poor research methods have led to lots of false findings in psychology, medicine, and other fields.
So this When I'm 64 study, how did they do it?
So the data gathering part of the study was fine, totally kosher. The researchers recruited some undergraduates to sit in a computer lab.
And you would listen to a song. And the song would either be When I'm 64 by the Beatles, or it would be a song called Kalimba, which comes free with the Windows 7 operating system. And then after that, you would answer a battery of questions. And then we collect the data and analyze it.
And that's where Simmons started massaging the numbers.
And we did that in a number of ways. So one of the things we did, I told you that you either listen to Kalimba or you listen to When I'm 64, but I omitted the fact that there was a third condition of participants who listened to a song by the Wiggles called Hot Potato.
Here's a taste of that tune for you.
Hot potato, hot potato, hot potato, hot potato.
But why does that matter? Is just playing an extra song, is that what got them to this crazy result?
No, that was just one of the many things in Simmons' bag of tricks.
How does Hot Potato play into it, though?
Well, I'll get back to that in just a second. But first, I need to explain something called a p-value, because this whole thing sort of hinges on it. The p-value is a measurement that's used to answer this question. If a researcher sees a difference between two test groups in an experiment, was that difference due to the treatment applied to one group? So in this case, When I'm 64, or was it just due to chance?
All right. So there has to be some way to prove that it's the drug or the treatment causing the change and not just coincidence.
Exactly. And for a lot of scientific studies, that's the p-value. Ed Gracely is a biostats professor from Drexel, and he explained to me how it's used.
Suppose in truth there was no difference. In fact, it's all just random. How likely would we have been to get a difference as good as we got or better purely by chance? Well, what we do is we calculate a probability for that, and that's the statistical p-value. And we set our criterion for calling it statistically significant if that p-value is 0.05 or 5% or less.
So if the p-value is 5% or less, scientists consider the difference they're seeing statistically significant. 5% is just the value scientists decided they could live with at some point.
So what we're saying is 5% of the time, even when there really is no effect, we would declare statistical significance.
That's basically an error rate of 5%. 5 times out of 100, your statistically significant finding isn't actually statistically significant. It's a false positive. The only problem with that?
5% of the time happens 5% of the time.
So if you run 20 different analyses, odds are one is going to be found, quote, statistically significant purely by chance, which is why it's bad practice to run extra experiments like making people listen to Hot Potato and then not report them, because your readers, the people looking at the study, don't know you had that extra hypothesis and then the higher possible false positive rates that would go along with it.
back to my question about the hot potato song, just that one extra variable made this whole thing work then?
No, this is where the rest of Simmons' bag of tricks comes in. When he had his undergraduates come into the computer lab, he also asked them a bunch of other questions, like their mother's age, their father's age, whether they would go to an early bird special.
What?
Yeah, pretty ridiculous stuff in this example. Then he sliced and diced the data. He ran the statistical significant test lots of times, comparing lots of different things, holding different things constant, until he landed on something significant.
That sounds like total nonsense, though.
Right. I thought so, too. So I asked Joe Simmons if what he'd done would get through a peer review for a journal.
We would hope that in the review process, if this paper actually went under an actual review process, they would be asking the hard questions that you're asking right now. But it's not a given.
So, really?
Yeah, it's not a given. I mean, when you are given papers to review, you're busy. And you don't always question every finding, especially if everything else looks good.
Carolyn, do researchers do this kind of thing on purpose?
Most people say no. I mean, there is a slight bias toward things that are going to give you a statistically significant finding. But Simmons is arguing most researchers just don't know that these things have as big of an impact on the end result as they actually do. Still, he says his example took the number fudging way over the top to make a point. As to how much this is actually happening,
different people in our field have strongly different opinions about how common these various things are.
Even lacking a consensus, there's been a lot more attention on this issue recently. An anonymous 2012 survey of more than 2,000 research psychologists found, though caveat the results are controversial, that some of these questionable research practices are actually pretty common. For example,
only report the measures that work, only report the conditions that work.
About half of respondents surveyed said they'd done that.
As you're collecting your sample sizes, you're analyzing the data and then stopping when it becomes significant.
That's kind of like closing the polls when your candidate is ahead in an election, and 1 in 7 respondents had done that. Now, reformers have emerged in different fields. Perhaps most notably is a Stanford doctor named John Ioannidis. He wrote a paper several years ago with the rather startling title, Why Most Published Research Findings Are False, and it's still pretty widely cited.
Oh, is he the one who talked about vitamin E to reduce the risk of heart disease, that actually doesn't work?
Right, that's the guy. Because of him and others like him, there are now conversations about how to fix this. I talked about this with Dr. David Chen, who's a Fox Chase surgical oncologist who reviews articles for urology journals.
I think that historically, if somebody had some outstanding, exciting breakthrough, usually journals did not question much about that data.
Chen says that's changing.
Now they are much more demanding that not only are results published, but access to the data is available for review.
In 2013, the British Medical Journal began requiring detailed study data for any drug trial results it publishes. The journal Psychological Science is planning on adding more disclosure requirements soon. Its editor, Eric Ike, says other groups are trying systematically to reproduce past experiments to see if they replicate.
Most research in psychology or pretty well any other field, it's all geared toward discovery. People get kudos for discovering new things. It tends to be undervalued trying to replicate somebody else's findings.
Carolyn, this story aired originally in December of 2012. So what has changed since then?
Mike, and there's really been an explosion of interest in p-hacking, as it's called, at least in part due to this bogus When I'm 64 study that came out of UPenn.
So what's been happening?
There have been a ton of journal articles on this topic. The National Science Foundation launched a working group. And about a year ago, a new institute opened at the University of Virginia that's incentivizing research to share their data online and try to reproduce past experiments.
So p-hacking, or the kind of data manipulation you talked about in your story that allowed researchers to say that listening to When I'm 64 made you actually younger, would it still be possible to get that kind of thing published now?
Well, I would say it's probably getting harder because increasingly journals are requiring more data disclosure when authors submit their articles for peer review. So Psychological Science, the journal that I talked about with editor Eric Ike, the beginning of this year, it started requiring scientists to disclose a lot more information. So basically, if the article that we talked about with the When I'm 64 study were published in that journal today, the authors would have had to report that they had the subjects listen to Hot Potato. They would would have had to report all the random additional variables that they studied to find something that was, quote, statistically significant. So the random variables, mother's age, father's age, and whether they'd go to an early bird special. So the whole idea is that with this additional data being required, you can tell a lot easier if people are cherry-picking their results.
Psychological science, are they the only ones doing this more rigorous approach to data, or is it becoming an industry standard?
It's becoming more and more common. Joe Simmons from the University of Pennsylvania, when I talked to him this week, mentioned a handful of social science journals that are requiring these data checklists. The journal Nature launched a data checklist last April, and Science now has statisticians review journal articles to get a more rigorous look at the data.
So it sounds like academics are working on this. In the meantime, what should we do as consumers? How do I know, is this study really true?
I think, as with anything, a healthy skepticism is key. And keeping in mind that one study is almost never the definitive word on anything, you need to look at a whole body of research. And there's almost never a silver bullet when it comes to weight loss or cholesterol. So that skepticism is really important. There are other things that people can look out for in news reports and medical literature to see how valid it is. And we have those pointers on our website, whyy.org/thepulse.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Thanks, Mikan.
Send me a postcard, drop me a line.